Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Platinum VIP Terminal. Experience private check-in, suites for relaxation, and then chauffeur-driven to your aircraft.
Welcome to Playback. On Thursday afternoon, everything changed in the race for the Auris. Louise Byrne from the Irish Examiner joined Cormac on Drive Time.
What's happened?
Really, really surprising news this afternoon, Cormac, about Mairead McGuinness. At 4 p.m, she sent out a press statement through the Fine Gael press office, and prior to that, she has sent an email, which we have seen, to members of the Fine Gael party, and she said she's made what she describes as a very difficult decision to withdraw her name as nominee for the presidential election. She said the decision was not taken lightly, and it follows a stay in hospital last week. She said her priority is now her health, and given that the election is so shortly, she said she does not believe she has the strength to give the campaign her all. So this is really throwing the race wide back open. She was the only person to put herself forward, so it really raises questions now for Fine Gael about what they're going to do. The executive is going to meet in the coming days and it'll discuss it. But Taoiseach Simon Harris saying it's not the time for that today. The executive council will meet, but the immediate right now has to be on Mairead McGuinness's health.
For sure, and our thoughts are with her indeed.
And later after six, this reaction from former TD and Fine Gael member Noel Rock.
It's a surprise and a sad one. Across the Fine Gael party and indeed for people up and down the country, our thoughts are very much with Mairead and her family. And we're wishing her the very best in the time ahead. We had a clear view that she would have made an excellent president of Ireland. That was a very settled and clear view within Fine Gael and indeed for many people up and down the country. But sometimes there are things in life that are more important than politics. And this is certainly one of them. So we're wishing her the very best and a full recovery in the time ahead.
From Drive Time on Thursday. But now the Fine Gael party will have to regroup and rethink everything should they decide to run a candidate. And that is looking likely. On the News at One yesterday, these possible runners and riders from Juliette Gash.
I suppose the names that we're hearing are names we'd heard before. Sean Kelly, MEP, Francis Fitzgerald, the former Justice Minister, and increasingly former Minister Heather Humphreys. Heather Humphreys was Minister for Social Protection and I suppose surprised many when she said she wasn't going to run for re-election last year. And then she said that she wouldn't be running for the presidential campaign, but her name does keep popping up.
Ooh, there'll be phones binging and banging all weekend. And of course, Thursday's bombshell news means that other big parties also have decisions to make.
So, of course, this changes the course of the campaign. It certainly changes the context in which the main parties, particularly Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil, find themselves in this morning compared to yesterday, because the fence they were sitting on just fell over.
So says Gerard Howlin, former political advisor and commentator on Morning Ireland yesterday. And Aisling Kenny asked him this.
There's been lots of speculation into Sinn Féin, for example. Mary Lou MacDonald hasn't ruled herself out. Michelle O'Neill also in the mix. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts in relation to Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil are this. There's an extraordinary opacity about their process. In fact, there's no process to speak of in either. Sinn Féin has had some sort of internal consultation. I can't tell you any more about it than that. As regards Fianna Fáil, its own members can't tell you what their process deadlines are. And that matters in a democracy for a very important position. Because you could be cynical and say the presidency doesn't really matter. But if you look at the last three presidents, Mary Robinson, Mary McAleese, Michael D. Higgins, their presidencies were deeply influential culturally. So it is an important office, and it is important that big parties who purport to be parties of government enter the fray and provide us the people with choice.
However, when it comes to presidential elections, there does seem to be a certain shyness, a certain reluctance to get involved. Because as we know all too well, they can be so very fractious. On Today with Colm, in for Clare, Dr. Teresa Reedy, political scientist at UCC.
presidential elections themselves, by their very nature, tend to be very difficult elections. And there are two really important reasons for that. One is that there's a very small number of candidates, and that's completely different to every other election we had. Last year, we had 680 plus candidates. This time around, we're looking at probably candidates that we can count on one hand. And the other thing is this election is about an office where there are no policy functions. It's not about your policy platform. It's about who you are. And that's why they are so intensely personal and so focused on the actual character and the kind of lived experiences of the particular candidates that are coming forward. And it's why so many people who might indeed have all the qualifications to become president really reverse away from it, because it's such a difficult election campaign.
But there are some names that are being talked about as possible candidates. Michael Flatley, Tony Houlihan and businessman Gareth Sheridan. He launched his campaign this week. But it's not been all smooth sailing. With column, John Downing of the Irish Independent.
We hear Gareth Sheridan, what a week he's had. I mean, to be very frank with you, I didn't know who Gareth Sheridan actually was until last Sunday. I should have known, of course, his importance in the world of business and pharmaceuticals especially. But, I mean, he declared last Sunday, and what a torrid 5 days he's had discussing, you know, his own past in business, that of his business associates, and even his own mother, her intervention in a planning application. So he's learning the just how absurd and banal presidential elections can become. You know, the 20-year-old drink driving charge, the night your milkman's brother-in-law double parked outside the dance hall, and so on.
Obviously, Gareth Sheridan at 35. None of those, we'd be hastened to point out, relate to him. Teresa, to you.
Indeed. And as it currently stands, we have one candidate confirmed, independent TD, Catherine Connolly. And we will leave that there for now and turn instead to the wonder that was Ambient Orbit on Thursday night over on Lyric. They were broadcasting live from the Dunmore Caves as part of the Kilkenny Arts Festival. And it was beautiful. From the depths of Dunmore Cave. Really beautiful. Well worth a listen back. With Oliver, playwright Marina Carr. The Boy is a two-play work based on the tragedies of Sophocles.
How would I describe it? I suppose what you're dealing with, you know, the Oedipus story, the Oedipus myth, if you know anything about them, there it's a kind of a destruction of the two biggest taboos really in the world, in a yes. world where very few taboos are left. If you kill your dad and marry your ma, you're kind
it's
of...
It's a pretty big one.
It's a pretty big one, I think.
Is there anything we can learn today from fellas going around murdering fathers and marrying their mothers?
Is there anything we can learn? Well, you see, it's, you know, they're such big plays and they kind of do the whole human condition. Do you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's so much to learn. I think pride is a huge thing. Sin, which we don't really talk about much anymore, but there are a lot of sins committed, or what would have traditionally been called sins. So how you deal with that, how you conduct yourself in the world. And the thing about Oedipus, I think, is he has a bit of a god complex. Yeah. He's a bit of a genius complex, to say the least.
The male ego.
The male ego, yep, on absolute display the raging male ego.
I can't see how that could be connected to anything going
on
in the world
today. No, not at all.
Today.
No, no.
Leaving that one there. But Carr talked about growing up and playing on the bogs of Offaly.
The place that you grew up in was Gort na Mona.
That's right, Field of the Bog.
So literal for Offaly, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, literally, yeah.
What was that place like?
Very beautiful, very rural, very Offaly, how can I put it, you know.
I'd imagine these summery mornings would remind you a lot, and yeah. Or maybe there's a longing for that kind of buzz that you get in quiet fields in Offaly.
Dragonflies on the lake, and you know, because usually the Midlands are the hottest when the hot weather comes.
Very hot at the moment.
Yeah.
What was the lake called?
Palace Lake.
And was it? Could you do recreation in those days on the lake, or was
Oh, yeah, swim. So we used to swim, and just play around the lake and count the swans, and throw stones into the lake, splash each other, diving and ducking and all of that.
Were you writing as a child?
I was. We were all. We had the theatre in the shed on top of the turf. We did. We had all these murder, all these vicious plays where people were drowned and boiled alive and crucified. And
normal children's fair, really.
Normal children's fair.
And she talked about her parents' lives and their creative household.
Did your mum, did she write herself?
She wrote a bit in Irish, yeah. Oh. And she was published, as far as I know, in the Garda Síochána magazine.
Really?
I think that's the only thing that was ever published by her. Because she was also a woman of her time, and she idolised my father, you know. Mm. So he was the, there's a bit of a genius complex in our house going on as well.
Really?
So we had a genius, we had a genius. So he was on the pedestal.
And she supported the genius?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
At the expense maybe of her own talent?
I think so. I don't disparage anything about my father. He was a very gifted man, but it was the times, you know. Mm. The woman kind of submitted, and, you know, it was all about the man.
If she wanted to be a writer like him, I mean, what avenue could she have had? It was difficult, wasn't
it? Well, I don't know, would it have been permitted?
By whom?
By the household.
Oh,
do you
really?
Know?
Do you think so?
Because the ego was quite huge. And, you know, it kind of, it took the air, I think. It took the air.
Wow, that's kind of quite profound itself.
Well, I don't know, Sarah, and it's, you know, they had a wonderful relationship in many ways. But I think a lot of it was her absolute adoration of him, and that built him up.
And her mother died in her 40s when Marina was 17.
Do my leaving cert.
Devastating.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. For all of us, yeah. But, you know, it's so long ago, and, you know, it's 43 years ago. So they fade on you, you know. And then there'll be days, you know, you'll be spaced and whatever, and the images of them will come back so vividly.
Yeah.
And suddenly they're vital in your memory. And Virginia Woolf has a great line about Mrs. Ramsey, you know, into the lighthouse. She's talking about Mrs. Ramsey. And she says, Lily Briscoe says, you know, what you said has never left. You know, so that memory that you keep of them, and it does sustain you, because it's very strange to be at the top of the mountain. Like, both my parents are dead now, so there's no one ahead of you.
That's
you're the next one that's going to be pushed off the cliff.
Does it sustain you when you remember, or is there a little bit of a pain there?
Well, it's both, you know, but it's, you think of how beautiful they were, and you think of how gifted they were. And then, because you can see another person's life much more clearly than you can see your own, you can see where maybe a couple of wrong turns were taken, you know?
Yeah.
The way you can never see with your own life.
Of course.
But you can see it with other people's. And when you see it with your parents, you think, I think all that potential, you know? So the way my mother sustained my father when she died, I mean, just the wind was out of his sails.
Oh, really, was it?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think he ever came back from that. Creatively, you know.
Wow.
Marina Carr with Oliver on Thursday. And at the weekend on Out and Proud, Trevor Keegan spoke to poet, performer and playwright Philly Speaks. And they talked about growing up in Longford.
I went to a very multicultural primary school and secondary school. I mean, the wider town was probably always inherently white Irish, but my immediate environments didn't make me feel unseen or non-belonging, because in school there was everybody that looked like everywhere. And in church, there was everybody that looked like my hometown or like my family unit. So that was a different thing. And then, so the two places where my world evolved didn't have me feeling displaced. So like between church and school, I felt at home.
And they talked about the difference between being brave and bravado.
Being from rural Ireland and being queer is a really difficult conversation. And I think the layer of being a child of an immigrant is also really difficult. But I think I have lived in both bravery and bravado. And so sometimes I forget the difficulty attached to that.
Bravado can be a mask.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think I've had to embrace bravado in order to get to brave. And I think now that I've arrived at what you would call brave, where you're just like, okay, you know what, damn the consequences, this is what I am and this is how I am and this is how I live. It can have that positive impact. And maybe it doesn't feel so much like responsibility because I've gotten past bravado. I'm just living in brave. I don't know, it's just that sounds so like and tongue twistery and airy fairy, but it's true.
Felly speaks with Trevor Keegan on Out and Proud. And on Saturday, after 30 years, Ciarán Hanrahan presented his very final Cayley House from the Fla in Wexford. And it was, as always, the very best of music. But he had not counted on this.
Thanks, Conor. Fair play. Mighty stuff. I have to go back here. You want me out there, do you? Oh, this is Aoife Ní Cormac. Do you want this microphone,
Hello.
Is it? Where did I get my notes?
No, I'm going to interrupt you just for 2 seconds.
Okay.
So on behalf of everybody here, especially the RTE team, which is Damien and Ruth on sound and myself, but everybody here and everyone in the RTE team, I just want to say congratulations to you on a remarkable 30 years of broadcasting.
You caught me out there now, I have to say.
I did catch him out. And I want to say it's been such a pleasure working with you, and you bring so much to every single programme that you do. So, Cochard, Chislat, Agus Gormila, Mila, Mahagat.
Gormahagat, Aoife. Thank you. That's twice this week I've been caught in the hop. Thanks a million. I have to say thanks to RT for the opportunity over the last 30 years to present this programme. It's just been amazing. You've been amazing. Our audiences have been amazing. Our listeners who are out there in their droves, I know I met some of them during the week and they were more emotional than myself about what was happening tonight. But I want to say thanks a million to all of you for being part of the whole Cayley House story for the last 30 years. I do appreciate it. Hands together for our listeners out there. So we're delighted that you're all here with us for this special night. Now, that's all that part of it done. That's the emotional part done. Okay, Aoife. Okay, we've got to go back to the Temple Michael Cayley Band. Yes, they're going to play a selection of tunes first. The first one is the Kilmovie. After that, James McMahon. Please welcome back the Temple Michael Cayley Band.
Hanrahan with his very last Cayley House after a mightily impressive 30 years. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now to wasps. Take it away, Oliver.
They are the yellow jackets, Vespula vulgaris, and also the German wasp, which is Vespula germanica. And they come out of nowhere. What should you do? And they're always on their own, aren't they? First thing to understand is the wasp is always a woman wasp. You're going, there he is. He's over here now. It's there she is, you must use from now on. Use the correct pronouns, for goodness sake. That she has small receptors. She smells, basically, gets her to the picnic table. And now she starts using landmarks to kind of plot her way to the food. You are the landmark. So you have to keep your mouth closed. Don't start shouting. don't breathe heavily because you're releasing carbon dioxide, which the wasp will use as a cue. And if you start flapping around and shouting, everybody knows this, though, don't they? You're behaving like a predator. By the way, their predators are mostly badgers in this part of the world. And then the wasp will have the attack mode triggered and she'll come for you. She's a worker wasp, so she's she's a busy bee, literally. And she's looking for food to feed her sibling larvae. She looks after the sibling in the papery looking nest back home in the house. So they do like meat, carnivores. Love a bit of jam, obviously, and your sugary drink that's there as well. So the sign that she's going to come back is zigzagging away from the table because she's reorienting for a kind of a return. So don't flap, share the jam, and you'll be completely grand.
Unless, of course, it's not your commoner garden wasp. It's this lad.
He's a bit like a wasp. He's about 2 centimetres long. He's mostly black and brown, little orange face, orange tail and yellow legs. So he looks like he's wearing long yellow socks. But that's where the cuteness ends.
She speaks of the Asian hornet. One has been spotted in Cork. That's Annalyn Vreen, Director of International and EU Affairs at the National Parks and Wildlife Service on Wednesday's News at One. And hang on to your honeybee hives, because these guys want them.
This is quite a significant risk to our own local biodiversity. This is an insect predator, and if it gets into, for example, a beehive, it can decimate the contents of the beehive. So it is quite a serious threat to our native pollinators and to our honeybee hive sector.
Why? What is it that they do?
They're just a very aggressive, like most wasps are, eat other insects, but this is a particularly aggressive one. It attacks, as I said, it gets into a hive, it destroys everything in its wake. And that's why it's such a significant threat.
And on Morning Ireland, this stark warning from Colette O'Connor, PRO of the Irish Beekeeper Association.
It has wreaked havoc in Europe. They did a survey in 2020 of 400 beekeepers in France, Spain and Portugal, and they found that just under 800 million was spent by them just to protect their honeybees. It didn't actually stop the hornet wreaking havoc, and it didn't take into account the huge number of beekeepers in desperation who gave up beekeeping, having seen what the insect did.
And are we dealing with just one Asian hornet, or might there be more? How easy is it for them to travel? Back to Anya Nivreen.
Yeah. And how is it likely to have got here?
That we're not entirely sure. We have a task force. We're looking at the possibilities. It is likely to have been a stowaway coming in through the ports. But, you know, until we do further investigation, we're hoping that that's the case. We've been meeting almost every other day to with the key experts in the room trying to establish where it came from. Can we catch it? Is there more evidence of something more sinister than just one?
Mm-hmm. Is it likely that there could be just one?
No, I'm not a gambling lady, but it's
hopeful.
Unclear.
We're hopeful, but you just don't know.
I mean, our best case scenario, it was one stowaway. Worst case scenario, it's indication that there might be a nest. So we're taking that approach that there might be a nest. So.
And if you see one, take a photo if you can and send all of the information to invasives.ie. And with Colm, yeah, we call them pests, but maybe they're the pets we have yet to discover. They may not have the Bambi eyes or indeed the soft fur. But it's time to ditch our shallow aesthetic discrimination. We need to embrace the creatures sitting up there in the ugly seats. So says Donna Mullen, ecologist and author of Make Your Home a Nature Reserve. Oh, and we're talking about pigeons.
They can sometimes look a bit bedraggled. You know, you get the kind of the sleek looking wood pigeon, and then you get the urban pigeon with the scraggly feathers and the battered foot, and you know, maybe it's that, is it?
Yeah, well, it's really sad actually. A lot of the city pigeons are missing toes, and again, there was a study in Paris, very stylish places, and for some reason they decided to plot, to count the amount of pigeons with the missing toes, and to plot over it the amount of hairdressers in a place. And it turned out that the pigeons that had the missing toes were in places where there was lots of hairdressers. So they think it's human hair getting caught around the pigeon's foot, and the pigeon can't get it off.
Just cuts the circulation.
And it cuts the circulation. It's like a little tourniquet. It cuts the circulation. It must be very painful for the pigeon. And like, it's a reason why we just need to be better at picking up our litter. Yeah, and now we have, you know, whatever, tooth floss and little bits of string and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. get. You know.
So if you're a bit put off by the missing toe of pigeons, remember that it's possibly
you've probably
caused even
it.
Humans.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You've probably caused it.
Which is a little alarming, given that they seem to have really good facial recall.
Hang on a second. The pigeon is learning your face. It's becoming familiar with you. So pigeons can tell the difference between different people.
Between different people.
So if you go to, say, Trafalgar Square with your little bucket of popcorn maize and all of that, and the pigeon comes down and eats out of your hand, and you're seen again by the same pigeon, that pigeon
it'll remember you.
Really?
It'll remember you. They can tell 1,800 different images apart. They can remember 1,800 different
images. How do we know that?
They just have amazing brains. Like, they are just, they're just fantastic. They actually did a study where they taught them art. So they showed that they taught them the difference. Yeah, the difference between Monet and Picasso.
Right.
So they taught them the difference between these. And then they showed them all Monet's paintings and all Picasso's paintings and asked them to file them. And they separated them into the two piles.
Right.
And then they gave them all Cubist paintings and paintings, Impressionist paintings.
Impressionist and Cubist.
And they put them all into piles depending on, you know, what type of painting it was. So there are
schools of art criticism in the pigeon world.
Absolutely.
And still these creatures are reviled. Maybe that's why. Maybe the artist started it.
Maybe we're all afraid of them because they're so bright, you know.
Fascinating stuff. Be more pigeon, because rats with wings, they are not. Oh, but what a segue, because it is to real live rats, and a lot of them, that we go. Sarah was on Liveline. Rachel phoned in.
My washing machine packed up at the end of January, so I pulled it out. I would be very particular around the house, so I would be very particular about the cleanliness of the house and everything, and I pulled it out. I discovered that there were shovels and shovels of droppings of varying degrees. Some of them were like sawdust. They were there so long. And the smell was horrendous. So we put down traps and bait, and they weren't taking anything. So we got pest control came in, and the guy found a hole in the wall in the corner of the kitchen under my kitchen units behind the kickboards. And we discovered that they had also found their way up inside between the wall and the insulation of my oven, the cooker. They had gotten into the extractor pipe. They'd eaten two holes in it. They'd gotten into the canopy of the extractor, and they were eating the oil, you know, from the filters. So I live on my own, and I moved in with my parents because there was nowhere else to go.
She has spent thousands of euro trying to fix this problem, but to no avail. But she's moved back in.
They are making an awful racket in the ceiling between the upstairs and the downstairs, particularly in my sitting room. And it's like they arrive in the ceiling via a lift. There's no sound of them coming up the wall, nothing. And they arrive in the corner. And I could have them in the three of the corners of the room. They haven't made it to the fourth one yet. And they're also in the corner on the opposite wall in the kitchen. And they seem to be moving along the dining kitchen area to another corner. But I was sitting on the sofa last Saturday having my lunch, and I heard one gnawing at the joist over my head. I could hear the timber. He was eating into the timber.
Oh, my God.
And about shortly after that, then he moved about 2 feet across the ceiling on the other side of it. So I think he ate a hole for himself and moved in. They came down the stud wall there actually as well. And there was a nest there because there was a baby rat came down into the floor of the toilet by the U-bend of the toilet. I know, yeah.
Sorry.
And, yeah.
Ooh, and very understandably, all of this is getting to her.
How are you doing?
Outwardly, I probably look like I'm all right because I smile a lot, but I am going off my head. I think I'm actually going to crack up.
Yeah,
it's really difficult, and I live on my own, so I'm sitting at home thinking, is this ever going to finish? And I can't keep stressing my parents out all the time and ringing my dad saying, Dad, I can hear him now, and where is he? Oh, he's over the cabinet, he's over this, he's over that. I don't know what I'm going to do, and I'm going out of my mind. It's very stressful.
Oh, that is really, really hard. But Annette, who'd had a similar issue, might have a solution.
What we did was, my sister said, she has a ferret, and she said, I'll send you up some ferret poo. So she got a lunchbox and she filled it up with ferret poo and she posted it up to us.
I don't blame you for laughing,
but
Rachel.
I think you might need a ferret. Now, the smell would knock yourself and all out. But she said to us, that's put it right on the perimeter of the house and just put it down. And she said, that will be the end of it. And it was. Yeah. So now, yes. I don't have a ferret myself, but I know you can get them and I can phone my sister afterwards and ask her where they got their ferrets. But
she might send me a lunchbox.
Or you could just make a call to Sam. He's a man who knows his ferrets and his rats.
Sam, you catch rats with ferrets, do you? Is that right?
No, I was listening to the show. I was a bit embarrassed to call and my nerves was gone. And I said, if them people only knew what I do, you know.
Yeah. I'm delighted you called.
My nerves are shot as well.
My nerves are shot as well, folks, all the talk of rats. So that makes three of us.
I spread the word about ferrets, how absolutely fantastic an animal they are. If you have a ferret will live till 12 to 14 years in captivity, either in your sitting room or a cage out the back, and he eats the equivalent of an egg a day. He will sit down any hole and he's absolutely brilliant. If I'm not catching rats with them, I'm out catching rabbits because they're absolutely brilliant, you know.
He does love his ferrets and he's a ferret breeder. He had 30 but is down to a modest 8 at the moment. And he keeps a few hungry. All the better to catch the rat and steel yourself, gentle listener. Sam was not afraid of getting quite graphic.
He'll fit in anywhere. And what I do, Rachel, is every single day when I walk out to the ferrets, I make this noise.
Yeah.
And they run to the wire because they know that's food. So if I'm in your bedroom or in somebody's bedroom or under the floor in the kitchen, I make that noise by wanting to get him back out. Now, the only thing the ferret won't do is he will not bring out the rat yet.
Oh.
So how do I get the rat out? Well, it's very, very simple. Very, very simple. You have to understand a ferret is an animal. So in my vocabulary is, you don't just bring one, you bring two or three. Now, years ago, what I used to do is I used to put a little collar around them and let them in underneath your joints. Yeah. But what happens when there's wires and, you know, copper pipes and stuff? You get tangled, exactly. So what I do is I make this sound, he grabs the rat, and most of the time he'll run with it, you know, to somewhere where he can...
What's the sound again, Sam?
Sorry?
What's the sound you make? Oh, okay.
Like a squealing noise, like imitating a rabbit that's being caught. If you catch a rabbit, he'll squeal. So if you make that sound, the ferret will know, oh, that's food, yeah. So he'll just come out to you, you know. Now, he doesn't take long. The only thing he'll eat in the rat, and I've done it a million times, is the most nutritious part of the rat is through the brain.
Okay.
Now, if you have an animal...
Sam, I tell you what, you know, because people are just finished their lunch, if they're lucky.
Lunch, she says. We're only on the breakfast. Liveline on Thursday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Oh, the 90s. Adidas tops, combats, bucket hats and a strut. And this weekend, Oasis are taking us all back in time when they come to town. And love them or loathe them, they are not to be ignored. And when it comes to loving themselves well, they have swagger in spades. From the Fanning Files, Dave took this little interaction with Noel Gallagher in an interview from 2008.
Okay, but Definitely Maybe, you say, like, I mean, like, would you consider that to be one of the greatest debut albums of all time?
It's not just me saying that.
Not just me saying that.
Right, okay. Okay, let's
Well, let's think of another one. You can't call Nevermind the Bollocks a debut album. That's just a piece of art.
It's the only album. It's not even, it's just a thing more than an album.
Go on then.
Okay, the first Roxy Music album to me. You see, I knew you'd laugh at that. Now, I'm not talking about later Roxy Music.
You're showing his age.
I don't care about my age. Why shouldn't I show it? Hold on a second. No. I'm not talking about the wine bar Roxy of later on when they sold billions. I'm talking about the first album.
Right, I would have to, you know, I wasn't before my time, right. I have to say. But I'll take your word for it, Dave. If you think that Roxy Music's first album, whatever it was called, I don't know.
It was called Roxy Music.
Roxy Music. Wow, what a title. If you think it's better than Definitely Maybe, then you'd be in a minority.
All right, well, then hold on a second then. Let's go to album number 3 of Oasis. Let's skip those first two.
Be Here Now.
Be Here Now.
Yes, a 9 million selling flop.
Oh, let's face it, it wasn't very good, was it?
Well,
there was probably good songs buried underneath there, and if you did the kind of unplugged album, you'd
it
find
wasn't.
Something
it like. Suffered from the fact that it wasn't Morning Glory.
It suffered from the fact that you had a big head.
Yeah, well, true.
And
you
thought you were the biggest thing in the world you could do.
Yeah,
to
well, we were.
Go, Dave. And on Today with Colm O'Mungon, embracing his superfan status, RT Sports Damien O'Mara.
Listen, I make no apologies about the fact that this is like midlife crisis inspired nostalgia overload this week. So
expensive midlife crisis inspired.
But, you know, Saturday and Sunday in Croke Park, you're going to have a whole lot of accountants and quantity surveyors and people who have proper jobs who are reliving their youth for one weekend only. And
walking in a slightly different way on the approaches to Croke Park.
And the bucket hats, which we've all hidden. Well, I've never owned a bucket hat. Listen, and, you know, and Nadine is probably eminently more qualified to talk about this than I, but you have points in your life where there's cultural forms, be they albums, be they songs, be they books, be they films, that mean something to you. And Supersonic came out when I was at the tail end of first year in secondary school. Live Forever was the anthem of the summer between first year and second year, and Definitely Maybe came out early in second year. So you're at that point in your life where, you know, things are changing. You're maybe trying to you're trying to discover yourself somewhat. We suddenly found this guy called Dave Fanning was on the radio in the evenings and was playing us this stuff. And Oasis was the cultural form, like them or loathe them, that came along for me at that time.
You can still hear the scrape of the plectrum down the guitar strings at the start of Supersonic, can you? Chill down the spine.
You know, I bristled slightly last week when Ronan, your producer, described me as a super fan on the phone. And then I realised from talking to my wife over the weekend that it's like having a personality disorder. If there's 10 criteria, I probably have 11 of them.
The first step is admitting to it.
I know, yeah.
And with Oasis, it's either the highest of highs or the very depth of the lows. They wouldn't be lads for the middle.
They have been responsible for probably my greatest gig I've ever been at and the worst gig I've ever been at. And here we are, whatever, 30 years later.
Well, tell us about the best now.
So they played The Point December 97. It was the Be Here Now tour and they did 3 nights. And Liam cried off one of the nights and Noel Gallagher did the gig on his own. And to this day, I have never been at a gig which has come close to it. Like, it was mesmeric. Just like Noel sang the vocals, an acoustic set in the middle of it. I think it was broadcast live on 2FM. I'm almost certain there's a copy of it in the RT radio archives. They did stuff that night that they hadn't done on the rest of the tour. They've performed songs that they never performed anywhere before or since. And there was just something kind of hypnotic about being in the old Point Depot with the sweat dripping off the walls and seeing Noel Gallagher on stage doing this phenomenal acoustic set in particular in the middle of it.
Right. They also saw they were responsible for the worst gig you've ever been at. The worst Oasis gig or the worst gig?
No, the worst gig ever. I went to Slane in 2009 and I think there's this this disproportionate nostalgia around that gig. So that was about 8 gigs before the whole thing exploded for them and the whole thing broke up. I remember leaving that early. And I think from talking to people that were at it, people go, Kasabian were brilliant and The Prodigy were brilliant. I thought Oasis that night absolutely phoned it in. And maybe hindsight is a great thing, but I walked away. I walked down the laneway in Slane that night before they'd finished going, I'm never paying money to see these again. here I am, €215 in a hole ahead of Sunday.
But.
Don't worry, Damien, says a texter. The Mayo lads always deliver in Croke Park.
Ooh, ouch. But for certain musos of the 90s, yes, we're talking to you, Nadine O'Regan of the Irish Times, Oasis, no Nirvana.
I probably reacted quite strongly against them because I was a really big grunge fan, and you know, Britpop really took over from grunge. And you know, there was a point where I guess all of the British music magazines would have had the likes of Kurt Cobain and Nirvana on the cover, and I was a big Nirvana and Pearl Jam fan. And so then to discover that the British music press had decided to completely jettison grunge in favour of this new phenomenon that they were sort of delivering to us via the NME, Vox, Q magazine, and they were sort of really bigging up all of these bands. And bear in mind, at the time, most of the time you had to read about the bands before hearing them, because you know, a lot of people didn't have MTV, we didn't have Spotify, the internet wasn't there, so you know, you were really stuck to actually get to hear the music. So if an album was recommended, you know, you were actually going off to pay quite a lot of money for a CD copy or a tape of an album. So the investment was quite large, particularly if you were a teenager. So when Oasis sort of kicked in, I was a little bit like, who are these guys and why are they taking over from my favorite genre? But then it has to be said, you know, I put on Definitely Maybe in my bedroom as a teenager and just blew me away. I thought Supersonic, Live Forever. I mean, those songs are enduring. And even if, you know, I wasn't as big of a fan as some others, and as time went on, I think the band themselves would say that, you know, their first two albums really stand as testament to the band, and some of the later work less so. It didn't change the fact that they really held Britpop by the scruff of the neck for a large period of the 90s.
And yes, this is nostalgia fueled, high on the fumes of the 90s. But on Sunday Miscellany, it was a memory from 2005 that had made the cut, from a Gaelic club in Sydney. The Strokes were playing the venue downstairs to launch their new album with a so-called secret gig, but you still couldn't get a ticket, unless, of course, your surname was Gallagher. This is The Only Guinness in the Gaelic Club by David Coughlan.
Someone behind us placed a half-full pint of Guinness on the bar, and every head in the room turned round. "Hey, Ringo Starr," said one of the committee men. "Where did you get that pint?" We turned to see who he was talking to, only to find Noel Gallagher of Oasis standing behind us at the bar with the only Guinness in the Gaelic Club. The committee man came over to investigate. He introduced himself as a Mayo man, and soon Noel was talking about his Charlestown-born mother Peggy while the other band members stood around us. Noel was friendly, humouring us about football and music, while Liam was quieter, staying in the background behind big sunglasses. Turned out the Guinness the Oasis boys were drinking was from a pub nearby, but Dennis turned a blind eye. Then he asked if Oasis were interested in Saturday's Cayley. Liam said they were booked to play Brisbane on the night in question, but that it was nice to meet some non-phonies. Then Liam ruffled our hair, shook our hands, and wandered off again. There was no velvet rope or VIP entrance to the gig, just a fire escape that Noel, Liam, Gem Archer, Andy Bell, and Zach Starkey, son of Ringo, disappeared through. We hesitated for a moment before one of the group said to us, "Well, are you coming?" So we followed them and watched one of the biggest bands of the noughties in the company of one of the biggest bands of the 90s, pinching ourselves to make sure it was really happening, while trying to stay as cool as Noel and Liam. For the Gaelic Club was the Irish emigrant story in all its glory. Community, culture, and two worlds colliding. Mischief too, Guinness or no Guinness. Half a world away from home.
From Sunday Miscellany. But as Sheila Nocton on Morning Ireland told us, this tour will be quite lucrative for the Gallagher brothers.
Should all go to plan, with no fallouts, the initial 14 tour dates are estimated to earn the brothers over €58 million each. That's before their stops in North and South America, Asia and Australia. But they're not the only ones set to benefit. Here's Richard Guiney, CEO of Dublin Town.
I think there's two real benefits. The first is obviously the monetary benefit of people coming to Dublin, which we reckon be about €45-50 million in spend in the city over that weekend, which, you know, additional spend, which is obviously very welcome. But also, I think it's part of the reputation of Dublin. We do events very well. We had Taylor Swift last year, and I think that's all very important in terms of Dublin's reputation and, you know, the marketing of Dublin. You know, it's all part of, I think, the promotion of Dublin and what Dublin is really about, which is a good place to be for a weekend.
Oh, it is going to be a big weekend for Dublin Town. So if you're going to relive your misspent youth or living at large the first time around, these gigs are definitely going to be ones to remember. Morning Ireland brought us this.
And my nerves are gone. Like, I'm dreaming about them every night for the past 4 weeks. I'm not exaggerating. Just make the most of being there, because it's probably never going to happen again.
I've listened to them for years and never thought I could go see them. A bit of drinking sure to go see them, to be honest.
Well, we grew up listening to them, so it's brilliant to go. We only got tickets like 2 weeks ago.
This is amazing, because this was bucket list and I wasn't sure if they'd ever get back together.
Oh, it's just great to go back to the 1990s and relive my youth. A great time to be alive, and just to relive that again would be great.
From I was a teenager, I just loved them, and now I'm nearly 40 and I can't wait to see them because I've never seen them before.
I'm really excited because they've been my favourite band for a good while.
Last I seen them in Slane, so the dream come true to go and see them again. Never thought it'd happen, so go with my girlfriend, so she gets lost in the crowd, nothing I can do about it. Ever a good time.
And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.